Black Lives Matter movement has to, by its very nature, be intersectional because of the complexities of who black people are in this country and throughout the world. There's nothing separate about wages from black life and the survival of black people than police violence and police terrorism. We even still have a situation in this country where we have black workers who are not covered by federal labor protections, like domestic workers and farm workers. So we certainly can't just look at the issues of police violence. Police violence is the tip of the iceberg when it relates to the conditions overall of black people across the globe.
In our 20th birthday Democracy Now! Special, we race forward to October 2014 to the world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author Noam Chomsky. I went with him to the United Nations to interview him in front of 800 people at the UN General Assembly. It included world leaders, ambassadors, and people who just crowded into the UN to see Noam Chomsky.
What do you think is the single most important action the United States can take? And what about its role over the years? What is its interest here?
Well, one important action that the United States could take is to live up to its own laws. Of course, it would be nice if it lived up to international law, but maybe that's too much to ask. But live up to its own laws.
And today we end with the late, great historian Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States. We spoke to him so frequently over Democracy Now!'s years. This is Howard Zinn in 2005.
Modern warfare, you soldiers fire, they drop bombs, and they have no notion, really, of what is happening to the human beings that they're firing on. Everything is done at a distance. This enables terrible atrocities to take place. And I think reflecting back on that bombing raid and thinking of that in Hiroshima and all the other raids on civilian cities and the killing of huge numbers of civilians in German and Japanese cities, the killing of 100,000 people in Tokyo in one night of firebombing, all of that made me realize war, even so-called good wars against fascism like World War II, wars don't solve any fundamental problems, and they always poison everybody on both sides. They poison the minds and souls of everybody on both sides. We're seeing that now in Iraq, where the minds of our soldiers are being poisoned by being an occupying army in a land where they are not wanted. And the results are terrible.
To see all of the highlights of Democracy Now! Over 20 years, go to our website at democracynow.org. That last voice, the late, great historian Howard Zinn. Special thanks to Mike Burke and all the team that makes Democracy Now! Happen over these decades. I'm Amy Goodman with
Juan All right, Gonzalez. The time is 8:02. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Positively Revolting.
Oh, no, this is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Break our legs, and we say thank you, and And good morning, good morning. You are listening to Positively Revolting right here on your community radio station, KBOO. Welcome to it. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we are here with Barbara Ford this morning. We will be joined by David Solnit in just a little bit. Barbara is an artist. She is an amazing all-around musician and often heard from guests here on Positively Revolting because she's involved in so many dang good things. And we are talking, well, the show is really focused on deep ecology and art and the intersections of art and the movement, many movements, really, and looking at an upcoming event that is called In a Time of Extinction, A Call to Life, and that is coming up here at the end of the month. And we'll be talking more about what that is in just a moment. But we want to welcome you to the show. Thank you for listening to your community radio station, KBOO Portland. And get ready to dial in and join the conversation. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning.
Thanks for being. So we have...
Here and being.
Well, sure, here too. We have a lot to squeeze in to... just a little time when we start talking about, first of all, just the title of the upcoming event really grabbed me in that conjunction of this dire time that we are living in. And yet, how do we stay awake? How do we stay alive? How do we not numb out? And I think, when I first heard that that event's title, it really spoke to me of the necessity for finding those things that that awaken us, that enliven us, and how do we find them in these dire times? So that's sort of where I want to start the conversation. Looking at, I know your work with Deep Ecology, currently you're working with 350, PDX, 350.org. That is an organization that is looking at some of the most grave conditions, right?
Yeah.
We're looking at climate disruption, climate change. We've seen some of the devastating effects that it has. And we've heard the conjectures of, the very place 350 got its name, right? If we pass this benchmark, we're really, really messed up. If we pass this benchmark, we're even more messed up. And if we pass this benchmark, we're unbelievably messed up. And then we're watching our societies, our cultures, our planet rush towards and past each of those benchmarks. How do we, how do we, again, keep working, keep struggling, keep dancing through this way to create change and stop the destruction? While we see so much devastation, while we, so at the heart of it, that's the nugget to me.
Yes. Yeah. It's the nugget to me. And it's a question that I'm always holding, of course, because there's no final answer to that or no clear answer for everybody. And one of the things I loved about this Kathleen and Rochelle McCabe offering this particular concert that we're also talking about is they just said sometimes there's just words alone can't express the urgency, or words alone can't keep us present. And so that's why I believe they that they brought in music and evocative music and spoken word oratorio into this to sort of we can sink into it. It's an embodied experience rather than an intellectual one. And I think that that's why I particularly feel called and sort of advocating strongly for the arts to bring people into the conversation, because it's like an entry point through our bodies and through our hearts that takes it out of the intellectual realm and brings it more deeply into a place of connection. I want to also say that... not everybody was born to be, an activist, in the traditional sense, that that not everybody's born to go to rallies or to testify at hearings, but that by allowing the arts in, it makes a space for more people of a variety of different skill sets and creativities to engage in the movement. And that's one of the reasons why I worked to create this team for 350 Portland that is allowing people who have gifts in arts and music and theater and other things to engage in the movement, because people are hungry to find ways to connect. And hungry
makes it
to
more
contribute.
Fun.
Yeah.
It's something that
and
this
it's more
is so
fun.
Enormous. This is so enormous. It is, as you said, it's hard for us to, for our psyches to accept it at all.
Right.
And for people to put their, and we've got, I always feel like the activist community has creativity on their side because it is encouraged. A type of creativity that is affirming, that mm-hmm. is something that makes people want to live instead of go open a vein. You know, or that it's not just trying to get over somebody and make some more money, but that the kind of creativity that's happening this is just, I look forward to the next thing the Yes Men do.
Yes.
I can't wait. Everyone, and it's like it gets around on the social media and all that sort of stuff. And in Paris, those are the things that we heard too.
Right.
In the climate conference there.
Right. And so it's inspirational when you see creativity. It's, and you get reminded about the beauty of the world. And the beauty of the world isn't just about nature, although that's certainly part of it. The beauty of the world is like people rising up and seeing, the energy of caring and compassion and solidarity, that is a piece of beauty too. And I was just, there's another event that I'm involved with coming up at the New Space Center for Photography. I was just curating a slideshow to present because it's about the role of images in environmental campaigns. And I was thinking about, as I was curating this small amount of photos that I had together, what did I want to show? And so much of what came out was the inspirational images of young people, testifying at hearings, or the kayakers in front of the Fenneca. And so it's just like the beauty of that sense of community coming together to serve the whole, to fight power over entities, and show the grassroots, the power up ideas. Hugely inspiring and beautiful.
That was legendary. People are still talking about it. And what I found interesting about that was that afterwards here, people kind of felt discouraged because Shell went ahead and sent the ship up. And then a few months later, I kept saying, just wait. I mean, because you and I mean, we've been around this block about 40 times. So, because for some people, that was their first action. And darn, we didn't do it right then. Yeah but it has a cumulative effect. And that is still, that was certainly a legendary.
It does. And the effect, particularly actually for people who are connected, the moment when the Fenneca that on that one day stopped and backed up, that was a moment. And so one of the things is I got to see some beautiful photographs of that moment of, so that's documented and clear. And it was beautiful. I mean, there's beauty. I mean, and to have a skilled person actually document that was lovely. So anytime that we bring art into the movement, it serves as sort of a conduit for people to digest this, to celebrate, to, even if it's difficult imagery or difficult, whatever it is, that it allows us to, our hearts to feel connected to it.
Absolutely. I'm reminded of my friend Justin, who often repeats the line, facts don't change hearts.
Yes.
Right? We can sit around and we can talk to people about the horrifying statistics that are involved when we look at our environment and the destruction thereof, and we can really just go for the polemics. We can be very well documented and scientifically based. Mm-hmm. There can be very little argument against the truths that we bring. And again, this is where we watch people numb out and want to find distraction. And art engages in a whole different level.
Yeah, and I, as a member of this person who's doing this art team, I have people coming who want to make art because it's like they tell me, I want to do this because I want to feel like I'm a part of something. Even if I don't even know what the outcome is, I need to do something. I need to do something. So making banners or big puppets or participating in a flash mob, it's like it makes them feel a part of a solution. And that's, I think, you know, it's a real gift both ways. You know, it's a gift to the movement. It's a gift to the individual. And so there's just such a wonderful way of, you know, feeling the connection through that. And you know, when things are devastating, we are stuck with the question of who will we be? You know, who shall we be in the midst of this? And I remember a quote from Joanna Macy many years ago. She was being interviewed about nuclear waste. And this is quite radical. She said, at some point, we may have to find a way to dance on the piles of waste. You know, like, who will we be? How will we allow ourselves to be changed? And how will we not allow ourselves to be changed? So,
absolutely.
Well, should we David into the conversation?
Let's do it. Good morning, David Solnit. Thank you for joining us this morning here on Positively Revolting.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. And David is currently working with the Immokalee workers in Florida and is also an artist working with 350.org. Is that a fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment, and I'm actually gearing up for a big mobilization with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers that I've been working with for 16 years now, who, in my estimation, use art and culture and storytelling probably the most powerful way of any group I've seen, in that they're, you know, low-wage migrant farm workers who have taken on a dozen largest corporations on the planet and demanding that they only buy tomatoes that are from farm workers that are treated fairly, and they've won each one.
Yes.
So we're going up against all the complaints.
Yeah, we, you know, and I think actually in looking at that example, one of the things that I want to return to this morning, one of the main themes, is how art actually can build movements and mobilize people towards social justice, towards taking action. And really, when we look outside the states, we see some vibrant examples of that. It's certainly in Mexico, the tradition of art and movements is very strong, that tie.
Yes. I mean, and I was listening to your conversation before I jumped on, and I guess the one thing I wanted to add on top is a strong affirmation that we understand the world not through facts and figures, but through stories and narratives.
Absolutely.
So not just our heart, but our brain, too. And my background is as a grassroots organizer, and I gravitated towards arts and theater because I felt like they were the sharpest tools in our toolbox of fighting, you know, life and death struggles like the farm workers here to win. And, I mean, my basic analysis, like many people, is that what we're involved in is a battle of different stories. You know, like the Koch brothers right now are funding huge public relations initiatives to change the narrative of collectivism, the idea that when people get together, they can take care of each other and make positive changes. They're trying to challenge that narrative. So we have to tell other stories. And I think the arts are the sharpest tools we have to tell powerful stories. So I'm always telling my arts friends, and I think everybody should have their fingers in arts, that to not just decorate the rally and the thing, but actually to get in there and help figure out how to tell the stories of our movements and take lead. But I think the singers and musicians and visual artists and performers have the most honed skills that we need to win our movements.
Well, I was reading an old interview with you about something that you did with using Robin Hood as the story. That was because I know in Mexico you see the stories of revolution. They have little in this one place. There's like a tourist store that sells wonderful revolutionary bags and T-shirts and
iconography.
Iconography. Thank you very much. That's the word I'm looking for. So you all used Robin Hood. We forget we've got him. That was, can you tell a little bit something about that story? I thought that was...
Well, yeah. It was fighting free trade agreements in the years after the WTO fight up in Seattle, we were going up against the free trade area of the Americas. And, you know, many of us who were inspired by the storytelling and fighting of the Zapatistas were like, well, you know, every Mexican five-year-old kid knows who Emiliano Zapata is and that he fights for ordinary folks. But who do we have in the United States? We have lots of people, but the five-year-olds and the 10-year-olds and the 40-year-olds don't know who they are. So we're like, well, let's take Robin Hood, you know, which is based on actual fights to protect the commons against enclosure in England. And so we did actions, and we actually took over the Pacific Stock Exchange with 20 of us dressed as Robin Hood and his merry men. And it was just a powerful narrative. You know, it was a fun way to tell a story that's like, okay, this is about, you know, standing up for ordinary people and poor people and taking back from the rich what they took from us. So,
and you got in with balloons. It was
we
beautiful.
Did. We actually, it's, we were trying to figure out, okay, how do you get past security to get into the very high security Pacific Stock Exchange? And so we had a lovely maid, Marion, lead us. And she had a giant bouquet of balloons. And so we said, oh, we're from Balloons and More, and we have a skiing telegram for, and we had gotten the name of the office manager inside the stock exchange. And so while they were, the security was charmed with the balloon woman, the rest of us jumped the turnstiles and rushed the trading floor and disrupted trading for almost an hour as a, you know, a complete melee took place on the trading floor, the futures trading floor. So it's quite fun, and we did it as well.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So, actually, I'm just going to flat out say that's brilliant. I want to look at, just again, what's coming up. It's on the 27th of this month, mm-hmm. In a Time of Extinction, A Call to Life. Music, philosophy, stories, engagement around our times and our climate.
Yes, and for those of you who don't know the work of Kathleen Dean Moore, she's a retired philosophy professor, environmentalist, writer, and she has been a clarion voice around this staying present and really engaging around climate change of late. And so I believe that, you know, she has performed this piece a few times in Oregon. I don't know if outside, and it's gotten rave reviews because it's essentially, it's her spoken word oratorio and classical piano that's Rachmaninoff's themes, variations on the theme of Corelli. It's beautiful, evocative music, and it's a way to allow this information to sink in. It's again, like I said, it's sort of an entry point into the heart and body. And so it's a benefit for 350 PDX. They're just very generously decided to come up and do this thing for us. And it's one of my dreams, actually, to sort of have these performances, because there's hands-on art making, but there's also performance art that can serve and contribute and bring people into the movement.
Oh, it's vital.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very important.
I want to invite listeners to join us as well. Join in the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. This is Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we are here this morning talking with Barbara Ford and David Solnit, both working with 350.org, locally or nationally, both working with arts, along with so many other things that they do. Just, you know, I could go on for the rest of the hour, but I won't, about the amazing things that they do and have done. Please do join us. You can also follow along on Facebook. You can like our fan page on Facebook, Positively Revolting, and you can follow us in the Twitterverse at Positive Revolt. So, in ways of staying present, in ways of not numbing out, can you, I want to throw this over to you, David. I know, you know, you've been organizing for, I don't know, let's call it something like 35 years or so. In that time, how do you stay present? How do you not numb out? How is it that you haven't decided, wow, this is a never-ending slog?
I mean, that's in addition to feeling that using arts is the most strategic, I think it also feeds me as a, you know, someone who's spent a lot of my life in meetings and organizing, and that I think we humans were meant to do things with our hands and especially together. So there's, you know, I think there's something very powerful about making art. I mean, I'm actually in Immokalee and I'm just inside, and there's about 15 people making tomato buckets and giant puppets outside in the yard next to where I am. And, you know, so for me, that feeds me. And my basic analysis is that all our movements should be doing what Barbara Ford and the 350 Arts team is doing, which is integrating, making things with our hands and music with our voices. And, you know, that's all we have is what we can make with our hands, what we can amplify with our voices and do with our bodies to change the world. And so getting to do some of those things, I think, is also the best organizing tool. I mean, I work with a ton of people who will never come to an organizing or planning meeting. But if you say, we're making theater, we're singing songs, we're doing hands-on art making, there's a whole raft of people who will show up. And I also encourage it for busy activists to keep their sanity.
Yeah, call it something besides a meeting. I think that's a really good idea. That's that's very creative because, I'm a person who would rather open up a vein than go to a meeting. Yeah.
See, now I love meetings. But I know, that's a whole other thing. Barbara, over to you. How do you not numb out? Like, again, you're looking at really dire circumstances. Yeah. And I know that you're in your deep ecology work, you know, with Joanne Macy, there's just so much loss. Yeah. And so much grief that wells up when you're really looking into what's happening. How do you stay present and awake?
So for me, I think that I sit with the idea that any of my responses to the world, be they grief or anger, are actually ways of connecting to the world, to belonging to the world. That, you know, if I was separate from the world, I wouldn't have those feelings. My heart would not be aching. So that's something, even in difficulty, to celebrate, to know I belong in this world and I love it, and therefore I will take action in whatever way I can or whatever way I'm called to protect and serve. Protect and serve. that came out funny.
But in a real way.
Yeah, but in a real way. But and the other part of it is the community aspect, that not only do I, you know, because we live in a culture of dissociation, and, you know, Western American culture right now is a culture of separation and dissociation, and it's the story of the Koch brothers. It's like, no, you know, we're not in this together. And this is like anything that goes against that message of bringing people together for in a joyful way to paint, like, climate justice umbrellas, for example, you know, beautiful objects that will serve in an ongoing way the movement, to bring beauty and, you know, attention to things, or just the coming together to make these things. It's a way of combating the story of separation.
And it's the separation, really, that I think that separation, that it turns into isolation, and it turns into fear.
Yeah, and despair. And so whenever I have people talking to me about despair, what comes, like, for example, in our workshops or just personally, it's like, so how can you feel connected? And making art, singing together, dancing together, and or coming together to listen, to create, you know, something, to a concert or to participate in something together. It's a way of bringing ourselves out of that sense of separation. Even if we're together in grief, we are together.
Yeah. It's always, this is one of those pivotal questions for me, because I have, done this work for quite a while myself. And in every now and again, okay, so I have done some work in, how do I phrase this? Let's say New Age community. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, 15 years ago, whatever, maybe a little bit longer, 90s. It was the 90s. I was a tarot reader in a bookstore. Okay, that was me. A couple bookstores, and I was when I wasn't doing my tarot reading in bookstores, I was helping to run supplies to Earth First camps, and I would come back and the ladies that worked in the bookstores would all tell me, oh, they just love the forest. The forest, they're so deeply spiritual. It's such a wonderful, that's so wonderful. And I would say, yeah, do you want to contribute, you know, some dry goods? I'm going to be taking them out to this camp. Do you want to come with me? Oh, we can't really think about that. That's such a bummer.
Like, yeah. Oh my God, like, please don't tell us about the clear cuts that mm-hmm. you have just gone out to witness. But we can't, that hurts our souls. It weighs mm-hmm. us down. The lines that I heard just really made my head explode. And it's that kind of separation, that kind of like, oh no, we just want to look at the pretties. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't really want to know what's going on. We can't because it's too frightening. It will overwhelm us.
Right.
We might feel anger.
Yeah.
We might have to do something.
Yeah.
That is, you know, how to reach out and say, no, actually, that anger is valid. It's the only sane response. Yes. And here's how we can work with that together. You're not alone. You're not isolated. You don't have to seclude yourself in an illusion. You know,
right.
Well, and I really thought that Naomi Klein and Avi Lewis's movie and her book, but the movie in particular, This Changes Everything, did a really good job of that, where she starts out saying, I really don't want to see one more movie about polar bears on the ice, and talks about stories.
Yeah.
And how that's the only way that we will all connect. And these ladies in the bookstore needed a story that was going to make them feel like participating.
Yeah. So I'm going to sort of take the lead here and ask David if he might be willing to share some of the stories from Paris, because I know you were in Paris, David, quite a while supporting a lot of the actions there. And I'm wondering if you might be able to share some of that.
Sure. Yeah, no, I come from a secular organizing background, but one thing I've noticed in the last few years is that a lot of the folks of faith, whether they be New Age, Christian, indigenous, or otherwise, seem to have actually better tools to figure out how to tell stories, and they already have their heads wrapped around narrative strategy, whereas I find a lot of my secular friends, you know, Karl Rove famously said, you know, we create reality, and that, you know, a lot of the global elites actually understand that, you know, in the history of propaganda, you can manipulate people. But flashing into that, I spent 7 weeks in Paris setting up an art space. And I guess one of the most powerful things it did is I was there during the terror attacks where, you know, over 100 community members were killed suddenly one night. And so one thing that the art space helped us to do is it gave people a place to come, and actually doing things with their hands together was very hopeful for people. I mean, a lot of Parisians who felt more deeply, because everyone had friends or friends of friends who were killed, came to the space, played music, made art, you know, and in some ways they felt like it was an act of defiance, and that they weren't allowing their lives to be terrorized. They were actually doing hopeful and collective things together. So that was one of the roles that it played, but we were also trying to find ways to make art in a situation where the government had used the terrorist attacks as a pretense to forbid social movements from being in the streets. And so we were constantly using arts as ways to amplify our voices and push those boundaries and back off the authorities. Yeah, and also contrast our behavior with their repressive behavior. So it played a huge role, painting 100-foot banners and hosting an art space where every sector of the movement, whether they're squatters from the Notre Dame airway or, you know, international youth groups from China and Africa, could come in and make what they needed and then take it out into the streets or into the COP meetings itself.
Can you tell about some of the installations that happened?
I mean, one of the funnest things was, one of the things art does is it kind of serves as cheerleaders. So while the government told us we couldn't protest, people were upset from the terror attacks, painting a 100-foot banner that said, it's up to us to leave it in the ground, you know, as our commentary that the elites meeting at the COP aren't going to solve climate change for us, it's up to us. And so we painted that, and the painting of it involved probably 50 people and was very exciting. We made a video of it, you can see online, and that excited people. And then we actually brought it out, and so we were at the Arch of Triumph, pardon my French, as they say, and we unfurled it in this in an area of the street. We took over four blocks of the center of Paris and did it in defiance of the police, who said, you absolutely cannot protest. And, you know, our coalition of groups stood up to them on December 12th and said, we're going to do it anyway. So the cops showed up the morning of and basically conceded to us and issued a permit, which we had never requested. So we did that, unfurled. So there
maybe
was
that's the way to get a permit, huh?
Yeah. Need forgiveness, not permission.
Yeah, right. Just showing up.
Yeah. But we unfurled the banner, and then, you know, and then the demonstration was supposed to end, and not even the organizers planned it, but everyone was leaving together, so people spontaneously marched to the Eiffel Tower. And so we marched to the Eiffel Tower with brass bands and a banner that we held horizontally as long as a football field, and brought it right up to the Eiffel Tower, and direct action folks from across the world sat down on the bridge leading the Eiffel Tower and shut it down for 3-4 hours and had kind of a festival right there. So that was, you know, it was in some ways the having the art and the bands and the singing was in some ways the most powerful defiance both of the French government and of the authoritarianism of the terror attacks coupled together.
Yeah, it really seemed like people ramped up their creativity in Paris, and probably some of that was because of the repression that was happening at the time.
Yeah, I mean, as well as around the world. I mean, I don't know.
And they were planning it anyway, right?
The march in Portland in solidarity with Paris was one of the more amazing street demonstrations I've seen recently. So encourage folks who want to put their creativity to use to tap into the creative organizing going on with Barbara and others.
And there are, of course, very creative groups in Portland. Mm-hmm. I want to go ahead and give a caller a chance to jump on in for the conversation. Good morning, Johnny. You're on the air.
Hi, Ani, and David, and everybody else there. First of all, I'd like to give a great big hand, two great big handfuls of gratitude to all of the supporters and the volunteers there at KBOO, and of course, directly to producers and the people who are Ani yourself and your other guests. And because I really do believe that KBOO is I believe is an art form. It's no longer a science, it's a science that has evolved into an art form, and it's like a living entity of its own arts. And the expression, I believe, is freedom, and how the many voices express themselves in that I think at this point in time, you know, I'd just like to give a big hand of gratitude just for the entity of KBOO. And oh my goodness, wow, what an amazing subject. I seem to be compelled to finding this very subject as a calling in my life in recent days. And it's such an important subject to me that I have been taking notes on what you guys are on the expressions that I'm hearing this morning. And what I'm hearing is just amazing and beautiful. And what I'm hearing is the act of the transformation of creating our own reality and creating our own reality in a form of the way we want to live our lives. And if you look at it in a deep, just baseline perspective, all humans are artists, you know, with our own individual expression, and how we express ourselves is our form of art. And so I really think that's a very powerful tool to bring inclusion into the picture, and be able to bring people together is to lend the understanding that we are all artists, and by changing the language, like you were speaking about earlier, from like having a meeting or having a rally to a type of performance art, transforms the language. And it's because I think where a lot of people get hung up on is the, you know, you say, you know, you hear a lot of activists, you know, say we got to fight for our right for peace, and we have to fight for our right for good food, and we have to fight, you know. And so that word fight, I think a lot of people are held back by that, and they, you know, we are basically products of our environment, and you know, there is a cause and effect to our environment, and what's shoved in our face is that value of separation, competition, and we encounter each other's paradigms. And so you never know what somebody's thinking when you tell them, yeah, you got to fight. You know, they could be thinking, oh, well, you know, I lost the last fight I was in, and that's just a sorrowful, you know, that's a
blessing. And it's not looking so good for the next one either. Yeah. Hey, Johnny, thanks very much for your call this morning. Barbara, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I had something that came to mind as you were talking, Johnny, and one of the things was, one of the things I do is I sing and I lead people in song. And, you know, when you lead people in song, you get a group of people together, and particularly a group of activists, but just generally people in this culture, in the culture of separation from our creative energies. A lot of people have stories about their voices and how they shouldn't sing. They heard something when they were young. And so sometimes I remember I did this actually at a 350 meeting. I said, okay, we're going to do a song. And people were like rolling their eyes like, oh God, I've got to do a song.
Oh, it's Kumbaya.
It wasn't Kumbaya. But I said, this is what came out of my mouth at that moment. It's like, so how many people, you know, how many people just sort of like don't want to sing, or they've told they shouldn't sing or whatever. And like, you know, 30% of the people in the room raised their hands. I said, so here's the deal. Here's the deal. So there's a lot of scary things coming down the road, right? We know that's what we're doing. It's going to be scary. So let's practice working with our fear by doing something that could actually bring us joy. Let's sing together. And it was like a way to transform that moment into, okay, it doesn't matter what you actually sound like. It's just what we're doing here together. And let's work with this, because it's going to be worse. It's going to be scary.
Right.
So let's work with it by singing, you know, even if your voice isn't what you want it to be or what somebody told you you should be, try to work past that fear or be with it and know that you're in community with it.
Yeah, that's a really good way to show that we have something in common, because everybody has fears. And yeah, perfect. That's such a good recommendation.
Yeah. Nice. Definitely. Hey, Johnny, thanks very much for your call.
Yeah, thank you.
Take care. And let's go ahead and get to our next caller, Rebel. Good morning, Rebel.
Good morning. Great topic. Revolution is art, and it is actually the solution. As you notice, artists of all types have been largely absent from all the movements. I mean, they've been there.
Really?
If you compare it to like the 60s and the civil rights, I'm talking about the mainstream. There's plenty of off mainstream creativity.
What would you consider mainstream movements? I'm just curious.
Check out the Super Bowl.
I'm talking about all movements. Like, for instance, Beyonce. Beyonce just did a Black Lives Matter halftime thing that everybody's getting all up in arms about on the elite side. And the reason why they do that is because it has great effect. And they're really scared of that. And so don't get me wrong. I don't mean to say that there hasn't been art and creativity in the revolution and all the movements, because there has been plenty, but it's viewed by a very small audience, and it's largely absent from the mainstream. So all the people that are watching mainstream media or just getting their news other ways or word of mouth, there aren't enough popular artists like Beyonce and things like that that are spreading that message. And you notice that when they do, the elite are just really upset about it. The police are all upset. Everybody's just, you know, mainstream media is full of, oh, Beyonce, how terrible of her.
Right. So, Rebel, David had, I could tell he was going to pipe up with something there.
Yeah, sorry.
That's all right.
I was just talking about the Super Bowl too, but I guess I would
I was contradicting Rebel on the narrative of the 60s, and that, you know, I grew up hearing, oh, the 60s were the stuff. And, you know, from what I know, actually, I think what young people are doing today in Black Lives Matter, immigrant rights, climate justice, is actually more sophisticated, is using art and culture as much, and in many cases more deeply than what was going on there. So I would push back on that narrative, whether it was the 60s and 70s movements or, you know, my generation, the global justice movement 15 years ago shutting down the WTO. I actually think what young people are doing today, you know, they've learned from our wisdom and especially our mistakes, and I think are on in all of those movements doing amazing work and throwing down hard on the cultural front. One of my inspirations is a culture striker group that my friend Paviana Rodriguez is part of, and she always says, thinking about the Super Bowl halftime, she says that political change is like a wave crashing on the beach, but the thing that makes the wave crash is the deep swells coming from the ocean, and that's the cultural change and the change of narratives. So, and it's people in the arts and Beyonce and others who help change the culture and the narrative that allows us to crash those big waves on the beach that we need.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I, you know, that's my main point, is that the art is really the fuel of the revolution, and that's really what communicates to people on the deep level. You know, rallies and things like that, while great things are said, there's a lot of people that are turned off to that for various reasons, whereas the art and creativity inspires and touches people on really deep levels. And I'm not saying, once again, I'm not saying rallies don't touch people. They certainly do. I'm just talking about the creativity and the art is a bigger fuel. It's like the jet fuel of revolution. And I thank you all for doing this, and I hope it spreads. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebel. Four. David, you had something more to say.
This one, I mean, one thing I believe in social change work is that it's not something that should be left to professionals or paid staff people, that everybody has the capacity to do that. And I feel the same with arts, that, you know, I hope people listening aren't thinking, oh, I'm not an artist or a singer or a musician or a performer. But, I mean, basically I view life as a giant bar, and we're all sitting at the bar stools. And, you know, how do you engage with the people next to you? And those are the skills that our movements need. How do you, you know, how do you tell a story and listen and make it interesting? You know, you don't sit next to a bar and monologue like sometimes rallies do for an hour and a half. You engage people and have it be interactive and fun, hopefully. That's my bar analogy. But,
yeah, because it's this is a long road, and there's got to be joy in it for people to continue, I think.
Yeah.
It just
quick solution is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I wanted to just sort of say that there's some, you know, fabulous actions that happen. I want to give props to a lot of local groups who are doing some amazing, like...
Do that, Barbara.
Portland Rising Tide has done some great work with art, and they made this giant Kate Brown puppet head and, you know, did some beautiful photo ops of and video showing her, you know, fighting the LNG on the LNG front, for example. And BARC and other groups are doing, you know, just some amazing things using images, using theater. And so I just want to give props up. I'm, you know, 350 is relatively new group compared to a lot of these groups, and relatively new into the arts thing. I actually started the arts group just a year ago. So there's people who've been doing this amazing work, and there's lots of opportunities for folks in Portland to engage with any number of groups doing arts, artivism, as we like to call it, mm-hmm. arts activism.
And what is it with puppets that makes everybody... It's like, they are always the very popular. They make people want to continue. I don't know quite what
giant
it is.
Giant puppets, you think
it is?
Are awesome.
I know they're awesome. I was just.
They also seem to make cops go wild. I'm just saying. From the late 90s,
there's no police training about what to do with doll like effigies, right. And it enters into a world of surrealism that puts them off.
Yeah, it kind of takes them off their script.
Yeah, that was seen. We saw that in New York. David, I think you were at the Shutdown Wall Street thing in New York in 2014, where they had the carbon bubble that was being tossed around, this giant, I don't know how, 10 feet across, giant inflated carbon bubble that was essentially started being thrown up like a balloon, and the police kind of like didn't know how to deal with this giant like balloon thing coming at them, and it was going back and forth, and it changed the narrative until finally it was popped on the horns of the Wall Street Ball, you know. But it was like such a moment to have, like, what do we do with this big balloon, you know?
I love stuff like that.
I mean, I think that's the thing that strategically to take from arts is to constantly be innovative, and as movements we have to be creative and stay on the offensive, and I'm often self-critical in that. To me, the point is, as someone who's made a lot of giant puppets, is not to keep doing the same thing, but I think of arts as like being a boxer in a ring, and when you throw a good left hook, you don't keep throwing the good left hook. You stay on your toes, figure out how the system figures out how to co-opt, assimilate what you do. So you dodge those blows, and then you throw a different creative punch, to throw in a boxing analogy there. But
that's I think that's hugely important, because if one is to do the same thing over and over again, it loses its impact. It fades into the background. It no longer serves as that point of connection. It is sort of that wonderful interplay of the unpredictability, of the spontaneous, of the new, of the spectacle, that I think is so engaging about art, especially art installations and art used as a part of the movement.
Yeah, and I want to add in that... So that's one of the things, the particular things that I think artists and anybody who, you know, engages in the creative process offers. Because what do artists know? Artists know how to try new things, and they know how to be in the moment and sort of read what's happening in the moment. And they know how to make mistakes and go back and start over, because that's what art is. So those are some skill sets. I actually did a workshop a few years ago called Artistry as Training for the Revolution. Like, what do artists know that will serve in whatever way, whether it's in actual art making or in other kinds of engagement? And I think it's a beautiful, I think it's something that we need to explore more. And David is a wonderful example of that.
And when I do workshops, I often push people in that. Usually I'll ask how many people here are artists, and most people won't raise their hands. But then if you poke at them, you find out so-and-so makes clothes, so-and-so cooks, so-and-so builds things out of wood. So people actually have all the skills they need. I actually think, similar to the idea that leaving social change to some paid professionals, I don't think we want to leave art and culture to, you know, a few unpaid, mostly professionals.
Yeah, that's part of the separation, the professionalization of creativity,
right,
is part of the story of separation.
You know, there's go ahead, David.
Yeah, no, I just challenge people. It's like, you know, if you make art, you're an artist. So, and everybody has the capacity to tell stories, to think about things, and to make things, whether it's theater, music, or visual. So we're all artists. But continue.
All right, we have just a few minutes left, and we have Paul Cienfuegos on the line. Good morning, Paul.
Yay. Hi. There's nothing more exciting for me than waking up to the voices of David Solnit and Barbara Ford on my clock radio. I was like, wow.
And hi, Paul.
I did that David is on KBOO this morning, and I wanted to ask you two a quick question. I am involved in a very last-minute action to challenge the Oregonian newspaper on February 29 that has the gall to organize a public mayoral debate and only invite two of the six candidates who are registered as mayoral candidates. So we are launching either today or tomorrow a major Portland petition to the Oregonian, saying you either open up the debate to all six candidates, or we will be canceling your event through massive nonviolent civil disobedience. And I just wondered, arts and culture would sure play a lovely role in an aspect of that, and wondered if you had any creative ideas. And thank you so much.
And Barbara, anything? No, I'm looking at but perhaps it's a pondering.
Yeah, it's a good question, Paul.
And it's always good to hear from you.
As you're pointing out, Paul, as a little corporate media, so why don't we set up a formal-looking debate right in front of the thing, and, you know, it could even be blocking the doors,
and actually ask a bunch of the very skillful people in Portland to deconstruct the role that for-profit media plays in limiting our options. I mean, you see that at every level. I mean, and that's, frankly, they're doing their job. You know, it's the role of elite media. So, but that sounds like too much fun.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much. Hey. Take good care. And let's sneak in one last call. Harvey. Good morning. Harvey from Berkeley.
I just want to, just a very simple phrase. Art is wealth. That's the concept. Art is wealth. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Harvey.
Okay. And let me just really quickly let you know what's coming up on KBOO this morning at 9, Veterans Voice radio show. Marvin and Angie celebrate 25 years, their silver anniversary on KBOO Community Radio. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. As usual, if you are not a member, it's so easy to do. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
You can do it. I want to thank David for being with us by phone. We promised to let you go after a half hour, and we've kept you on a lot longer. And we thank you for that. David,
thank
you.
Me.
You're welcome.
Thanks, David.
David Solnit joining us from Florida, where he's working with the Immokalee Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And he is the arts consultant for 350.org. Thank you, David. And Barbara, before we let you leave the studio, one more time, can you give us the details of this upcoming event, In a Time of Extinction, A Call to Life?
Yes, this is a concert that's going to be happening on Saturday, February 27th at 7 p.m. at Central Lutheran Church, which is at 1820 Northeast 21st Avenue. And tickets are available. We're trying to, it's a fundraiser, so at any rate, go to 350pdx.org for information about coming to this concert.
It's also on Facebook.
It's also on Facebook. Kathleen Dean Moore, Spoken Word, and Rochelle McCabe, world-class classical pianist.
Fantastic. And any final words for those folks that are still sort of, it's kind of bougie. What's it for anyway?
Yeah.
That art.
What's it for? it's not doesn't have to be bougie. As David said, everybody's an artist, and so we all have some creative energy that is there to serve our hearts and serve the heart of the world. So, why not make that connection? Why push that aside? That, again, that's a story of separation. So stay with the story of belonging and belong to your creativity and bring it to the world.
There's the Zimbabwean proverb, if you can walk, you can dance. If you can talk, you can sing.
Yes.
And I have always found that quite inspirational.
Exactly.
Yeah. Art too important to be left in the hands of professionals.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you, Barbara, for joining us as always. So delightful to talk with you. Delightful to have the opportunity to talk to David Solnit as well. And we will be back next week with John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And we will continue to be positively revolting.
This is it.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Wamba at the Analog Cafe, Friday, February 19th at 10 p.m. Wamba is a Portland-based band that mixes traditional West African rhythms from Ghana with jazz, funk, and Afrobeat styles. Friday, February 19th, there will be a special two-set performance. The evening starts at 10 p.m. at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.